There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
On the evening of September.
I'm on the line with Adil.
Welcome to the November edition of No One Is Illegal Radio. We're part of the CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. On this month's edition of No One Is Illegal Radio, we'll hear more about the disruptions in Victoria, BC of the Olympic torch relay. Activists have come together under the slogan No Olympics on Stolen Native Land. Later on the show, we'll hear from members of No 2010 Victoria. Also on today's show, we'll learn more about the proposed changes to the temporary work programs for migrants in Canada, which continue the trend of making migrant workers' status more precarious. For background to these changes, we speak with Syed Hassan of No One Is Legal Toronto. But first up, we'll hear from Adil Sharkawi. Adil was living under a draconian security certificate since 2003, but was recently completely vindicated. On today's show, we have an exclusive interview with Adil Sharkawi. This month's show is produced by members of the No One Is Illegal Network in Montreal, in conjunction with the CKUT Community News Collective. No One Is Illegal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance, fighting for justice and dignity and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Our campaign is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, denouncing and taking action to combat racial profiling, police brutality, detentions and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous people on Turtle Island. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host for today, Robin Maynard, a member of No One Is Illegal Montreal. First up, we're going to go to an interview with Adil Sharkawi. As our listeners no doubt know, Adil has resisted a draconian security certificate against him since May 2003. Under a security certificate, a non-resident of Canada is put under suspicion of illegal behavior, but does not have access to the full evidence against them, nor do they have the right to an open and fair trial to determine whether they're actually guilty or not. This process has been described as Kafkaesque. After Adil was put under a security certificate, he spent more than a year in detention. When he wasn't in detention, he was under strict conditions, including curfew, the forced wearing of a GPS tracking device on his ankle, and more. One of those conditions included not talking to anyone with a criminal record, which made it hard for some members of No One Is Legal to interview him. Recently, Adil has been completely vindicated. The Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, CSIS, can't provide any reliable evidence in court to sustain the security certificate, and now the certificate against him has been quashed. This represents a major victory in the ongoing struggle against draconian and racist so-called security measure. No One Is Legal member Jaggi Singh was able to interview Adil earlier today, and we go to that interview right now.
I'm on the line with Adil Shekrawi. Adil Shekrawi was under a security certificate since 2003, but recently was vindicated. The security certificate was dropped. Adil, welcome to No One's Legal Radio.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Adil, this is the first time that we can actually chat because under your previous conditions, you were prevented from speaking with people like myself who might have a criminal record. So it's a pleasure to finally be able to speak with you and to solicit your views.
Yes, it's a pleasure to enjoy my freedom.
I'd like to say congratulations, and I will, but it's kind of weird to say congratulations when this should never have happened in the first place. So tell our listeners, I'll offer my congratulations, but do tell our listeners the situation that you're in now. What happened in the last few weeks that has drastically changed the situation you're in vis-a-vis the security certificate?
But my nightmare stopped, I will tell you, since 14 October when the judge declared revoked my security certificate. But I can tell you that even before, when I cut my shameful bracelet, I started to be more free, and I could finally enjoy my freedom after years and years of detention, of surveillance, of wearing this bracelet and respecting 40 conditions for more than 40 years and a half. Finally, I could have more freedom. But I will tell you that I'm free now. I have no conditions. I can go everywhere. But the government didn't really recognize this decision. Because until now, I didn't get any apology from the government. The seat is still sending false information about me to the media. Their new director sent an open letter to Ottawa citizens talking about my case. And last week he did a speech in Toronto and he talked again about me. So this is really shameful for the Canadian justice system. We have the courts who give me finally my freedom and some justice. But CSIS didn't really recognize the decisions of their own courts.
Could you speak a bit more, Adil, about the role of CSIS, the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service? There's all kinds of different levels of the Canadian government that are involved on the political level, on the bureaucratic level. But the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service seems to play a unique role in this case with you. Could you describe that role from the very beginning when they began to, I would describe, harassing you and harassing your family?
But everything started when I asked for the Canadian citizenship in 1999. Since this time, I felt to be followed by cars. I noticed that a lot of my friends stopped calling me, and I started also losing jobs. And I didn't realize at the time that I was followed by CSIS agents. I didn't even know that CSIS exists at this time. But after I was released, I talked with some friends and some neighbors, and they told me that they received many visits from CSIS agents showing my picture and telling them this guy's really, really dangerous, that sucks to him. Can you give us more information about him? So it started in 1999, but I cannot have evidence to show it, because I at this time I didn't know about my case. But after 9/11, they became more aggressive, and they started asking me to meet with them in the immigration building in Saint-Saint, Saint-Antoine, and there they started asking me questions about myself, my family, my opinion, my religious beliefs, my political opinions, and showing me also pictures for the Muslim community, asking me about people in my community. So I met with them perhaps 5 or 6 times. I didn't really remember. In the beginning, it was in the building. After they started building of immigration, Canada. After they started visiting me in my job, and I told them that I don't want to see them in my house, so they never came to my house. They were just waiting for me near my job or my house. And when I realized that they're not really doing any investigation, they just want to have more information about innocent people, and they want to push me to become a snitch, I told them go to the hell, and I don't want to work with you, because my vocation is to be teacher, not a snitch on my own community. They gave me some threat, and they told me clearly that if I don't work with them, I will never be Canadian citizen, and I will be deported to my own country. So this time I didn't know about security certificate. I told them, no way, I'm a landed immigrant. My parents are Canadian. My sister is Canadian. I have a daughter with Canadian. So all my family now are living in this country for a long time. And how can you deport me? Because just I don't want to collaborate with you against innocent people. So After 2003, I understood that those people are really powerful here in Canada, and they don't respect any law, any ethics, any rules. They are doing what they want, and they have carte blanche to do what they want. But I was really lucky to get support of many activists, and Dagi, you were one of them. So and the Coalition Justice for Sharka, we did a great job, and many, many other associations like No One Is Illegal or Solidarity Cross Border, the Muslim Council of Montreal, CAF, CARECAN, lots of other, La Ligue des Droits et Libertés. So all those NGOs and activists for social justice started working with my family, and we did a great campaign, and I was also lucky to get wonderful lawyers who really didn't fear to say the truth in the court, and to show that it was big injustice to put me in this nightmare. So we started our campaign in 2003. Since the first day when I was put in jail, I called the media, and I told them this is a witch hunt, and this is a new form of McCarthyism. Those people, they are not fighting terrorism, they're just fighting to get a bigger budget, and they are using me like a tool, and I'm asking Canadians to be smarter, and don't trust those people. If they have any evidence against me, I'm challenging them to show it to the public and to let me defend myself. But to arrest me in the base of secret evidence, this is shameful for a country like Canada. Are we going to have now secret trials after all those years of justice and check and balance? So I will tell you, it was a long shot, and finally we could achieve something wonderful. We won twice in the Supreme Court, and we forced them to change their own policy to respect the charter. And the Supreme Court also declared this law unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the government, we didn't get a good government. The conservative government just rewrite another law with the special advocates. And our slogan at this time was no circ, no clown. We didn't want any new legislation based on the CERC, the CESAR, the Committee of Supervising Activities of CSIS, or what we call the clowns. It means a special advocate, an advocate that I will not choose, but the government will choose it for me, and they will he will be introduced to the secret hearing to not to defend me, but just to have an idea about those evidence. So I'm telling you in some sentences, perhaps 7 years of suffering, of struggle, of campaign, of demonstrations, of conferences, of a lot of interviews, a lot of lobbying, a lot of popular camp, and workshops. So I think we it was a nightmare, but it was also a fantastic experience of learning how to become more citizen, more involved in the community. So I lost a lot, but I also learned a lot during all those years.
Adil, while we celebrate your victory, we know that there are other families, other men who are affected by security certificates, one of whom is still in detention. And throughout this process, there's been solidarity between all those families. The government, CSIS in particular, likes to play divide and rule, and you refuse to play that divide and rule game. You've been vindicated, but I'm wondering if you could share a few words about the other men and the other families with their supporters that are still fighting for vindication and to have the security certificate finally lifted.
I would say that a lot of people are saying it's a victory. Yes, this is a victory, but how can we celebrate today and Mahjoub is doing hunger strike for more than 100 days? How can we celebrate and Harkat and Zaballah and Al-Mara'i still wearing shameful bracelets? It's really difficult for us to celebrate because it's not the end of this injustice here in Canada. And we can be celebrating when this law will be abolished, when those people will be released, when they will get not just the freedom but the justice and the recognition of the mistakes of the police state. So it's I will tell you what, we are going to have a celebration 26th November in the community center in downtown, and we are inviting all the activists and all people are listening to your broadcast to come. They're all invited. But this is a celebration not just to have a fun, but to also reflect on how to have a very strong campaign and to help other people. Unfortunately for them, they are living in Ontario. In Ontario, it's not the same context. Here in Quebec, I will tell you that people are fundamentally against secret trials, but they're... I did the Canadian tour and I found that in Ontario, people, even activists, they don't have the same level of critical sense like Quebecers. So sometimes they're accepting some of, not evidence, but allegations in the government, from the government, from CSIS. So they need more education, I think, to find the what is true behind those four cases. You cannot detain somebody for 8 or 9 years without giving him a trial, without showing him evidence, without letting him cross-examining the informants. It's we cannot believe it. It's indefinitely detention without any respect of rules of law. And I will tell you that we want to celebrate, yes, but our hearts are not ready for celebrations. So We're just using these moments perhaps to reflect on our campaign and to see what we can do for the future of other people who are suffering from this injustice.
Adil, you spoke about how various activists, various social justice communities supported you throughout this process. And I think some of them now rely on your advice and your counsel. CSIS, for example, has been making very, very active visits within activist communities in anticipation of the upcoming Winter Olympics and people who are going to resist. I'm wondering if you can share for us your advice on dealing with CSIS. Clearly, you had to deal with them in a much more precarious position because you didn't have your citizenship yet. But CSIS is also visiting people who don't have that problem. They have their citizenship. Their citizenship will not be revoked. Can you share your thoughts about when CSIS comes knocking?
When CSIS comes. This is, I think, a very important thing to reflect on it. I'm asking all my friends and all the activists of social justice and all people who are struggling for more dignity and for more justice, not to talk to those people directly without a lawyer. This is very important. You cannot trust them. Don't play the hero. With those people, I did a big mistake. You cannot trust them. They are big liars. They can lie. They can record the conversation and destroy the tapes and make summaries and destroy the summaries and make some analysis of those summaries. So it's really, really important not to talk to them. You must have with you a lawyer. This is really important. And I will tell you that even if you have a lawyer, try to record the conversation and keep it in the file. It's important for your protection. And I'm not scaring anybody. I'm not scared at all from those people. But we don't need to let them have more budget based on stupid words. You can just record people and have more power and more, and it's like a vicious circle. So we don't want to collaborate in this vicious circle. We don't want them to have more budget and to be more involved in our own privacy. So it's really important first not to talk to them except with a lawyer. The second point, I would tell you that it's really important also to enjoy our freedom of expression and not to be paranoiac. Sometimes I notice that some activists started to be paranoiac, not to use the phone, not to use. I was really surprised to see it even in Canadians. So in the beginning, I thought it was just in my own community when people are illegal or they are not citizens. But after my experience, I noticed that even it started to be present within Canadians. So this is also disturbing. We don't have to be paranoid, but we have to be, wiser and smarter than those people. This is a very small advice I want to give to all my friends and your listeners.
Adil, it's again a pleasure to be able to talk to you directly now that your conditions are gone and you've been vindicated. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us on No One Is Legal Radio.
I really want to thank you again, to thank all your listeners and all activists from No One Is Legal. It's really, you're really doing a great job to the community. Thank you.
Culture Shock, November 2nd to 6th. Culture Shock is a week of events dedicated to exploring the myths surrounding Indigenous, immigrant, refugee, and communities of color. Culture Shock is a joint effort brought to you by the McGill Student Society, Kuiperg McGill, and the McGill Anti-Racist Coalition. Culture Shock 2009 will feature a keynote panel, a party, roundtable discussions, walking tour, and a series of fun workshops. The keynote panel for this year's Culture Shock is 1947-48, The Decline of the British Empire and the Rise of Border Conflict. conflicts. The panel will consider 1947-1948 as a year that the British quit or handed over many of its colonies. The point of the panel is to look at contemporary border conflicts like Palestine, Kashmir, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka within a historical context. Speakers include Radha D'Souza, Mazen Masri, and Guru Barnam Gunanatham. For more information, contact 514-398-7432 or qpirg@ssmu.mcgill.ca. For the full schedule for Culture Shock, please visit www.qpirgmcgill.org. That's qpirgmcgill.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
It's Expozine 2009, Montreal's 8th annual Small Press Comic and Zine Fair. Happening on Saturday, November 14th and Sunday, November 15th from noon to 6 at 5035 Saint-Dominique. Expozine is Canada's largest small fair press, with nearly 300 independent publishers selling all sorts of books, comics, zines, and posters. Featuring readings and discussions each afternoon, a fantabulous opening party on Friday, November 13th. See Expozine.ca for more details. That's Expozine, November 14th to 15th at 5035 Saint-Dominique. Expozine is a CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One Is Legal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host, Robin Maynard. Next up, we'll get some perspective about recent changes to the temporary work programs to be passed as a new regulations by the Conservative government and its notorious immigration minister, Jason Kenney.
We came after Jason Kenney recently here on the McGill campus. Jason Kenney was going to address a group of members of Conservative McGill, and No One's Legal, along with a lot of our allies, were able to confront him. And we actually presented Jason Kenney with a serious case. That morning, we had learned through an article in the Toronto Star that a Mexican woman named Grisa, who had applied for refugee status with her sister and her mother twice and was twice rejected, was found murdered in June in Mexico by the very people who she feared persecution from.
This is in the context of Jason Kenney, who's actually been very adamant about the fact that my potential refugees from Mexico are bogus refugees, and there's too many of them because they do not legitimately face a threat in their home country. So actually that same morning we were faced with a case of a woman who had actually been killed because her refugee status was rejected.
Yeah, not only is he using this rhetoric of bogus refugees, which just panders to sort of redneck racist sentiment, but he introduced visas for people coming from Mexico and also the Czech Republic based on that rhetoric. So we brought up this case, and we were pretty surprised that he just passed by, and he laughed it off. And when we pointed out that he's pandering, it was very careful language we use, he's pandering to racists, he said, with a bit of sarcasm, to be fair, but he said, I plead guilty, I am a racist, and he pushed his way in with his entourage into the room. Although, from what we hear, both from Conservative McGill and from others, the event was thoroughly disrupted.
Yeah, that's true. And on the theme of that, to go with the interview that we have up next, under the Conservative government, Jason Kenney, they're also changing the regulations of the temporary work program. So this is another way that you can see, not just trying to keep refugees from entering the country, but when migrants come to work in Canada, they're making it more and more difficult for them to have access to rights and to be able to stay here with dignity.
There's been a clear trend pretty much from every immigration minister, but particularly under Jason Kenney, it has to be said, of making people's status more precarious, of limiting people's ability to get into the country, of blaming the victim, blaming people for what's happening. And yeah, this recent change that they're proposing to temporary migrant workers and their status is just the latest in this.
It's true. And what it does is it's pretty much boosting the Canadian economy because people are still coming here to work, but it's just easier to exploit them because of the precarious status that it leaves them in. So for more details, we'll go to that interview with a member of No One Is Legal Toronto right now.
Yeah, this interview was done earlier today, and No One Is Legal Toronto, along with a lot of others, are spearheading opposition to these changes, which we'll hear more about in this interview. I'm speaking with Syed Hussain. Syed Hussain is a member of No One Is Legal in Toronto. He is also involved with the Coalition for Change, Caregiver, and Temporary Workers. Hussain, welcome to No One Is Legal Radio.
Hi, thank you.
Hussain, you're active in opposing some proposed regulations that are going to go into effect very soon, in just a little over than a month. These regulations affect temporary workers. Describe for our listeners what exactly the Canadian government is attempting to do vis-a-vis temporary work programs and temporary workers.
Yeah, maybe I'll start by laying out what the temporary worker program is for folks who may not entirely know. So the temporary foreign worker program in Canada essentially consists of three streams. There's the live-in caregiver program, there's the seasonal agricultural worker program, and then there's something called the temporary foreign worker program, occupation classifications A, B, C, and D. A and B are considered quote-unquote high-skilled, and C and D are considered quote-unquote low-skilled. Now, in total, in 2008, we had nearly 250,000 people enter the labor market as temporary workers. That number is higher than the number of people who have access to permanent residency. I mean, who are able to apply, who actually applied for it. Not certain whether all of them will get citizenship. Now, within the temporary foreign worker program, C and D, which affects about 100,000 people or more a year, because we're seeing dramatic increases. There were two regulations, and essentially the regulation was that you worked in the country for 8 months, and then you could leave for 4 months, and then come back after every 8 months at the end of the season, etc. And then what we've seen is two regulations have just come down into on the 9th of October, and they basically, the first one says that people can stay in the country indefinitely, right? So they don't have to leave for 4 months. But the next one says is at the point where they are cumulatively been in the country for 4 years, they then cannot re-enter the country for 6 years. So what it is it's a four-year-long deportation permit. You stay in the country for 4 years, you work, you may be able to build relationships, have friendships, be able to unionize, organize. But at the end of 4 years, all of that is ended and you have to leave. And so it's essentially entrenching the precarity and temporariness as much as is humanly possible.
This is all being done through regulatory changes, not through any act of legislation, from what I understand.
Yes, and that's one of the biggest problems. This is entirely undemocratic, the little that means, and it's completely non-transparent. Any change can essentially be issued through a regulation. And we see the same thing with the refugee numbers. I'm sure you've noticed just last week, Kenny comes out and says, well, we're going to cut refugee numbers from 22,000 to 9,000. He can just come out and say, we're going to change this. And the process is really crazy. What it is essentially, it gets published on a website, the Canada Gazette, and then you have 60 days to respond to it. And so this, and usually what we've seen with regulations is that people send submissions and the authorities just throw them away. And this time we're not going to let it go quietly. So we're calling, we've written a statement that's been endorsed by organizations around the country. It's on our website. And we're asking people to sign it. There's a petition attached. We're asking people to attach it, sign the petition. And we're calling for a National Day of Action on the 1st of December to let the government know, let the Tories, and you know, none of the MPs have spoken out against it. It's this really quiet issue, and so we're calling for a day of action because this is undemocratic. It's completely not transparent, and it's completely opposite to the demands we've been putting out, which is permanent status on landing for all people.
The phrase that people often use is good enough to work, good enough to stay. And you have situations where some migrant workers have worked here 8 months a year, 9 months a year for up to two decades and still mm-hmm. can't claim any status. Mm-hmm. And this is the direction in which immigration policy is moving into. So could you talk a bit more about that? The fact yeah. that other classes of immigration that people have tended to access, family class, or just simply immigrating here and working here and then staying here, a very simple process, mm-hmm. is now being moved into this temporary status. And even that temporary status is becoming even more precarious. Talk about the logic behind that and that dynamic.
Of course. First, I just want to say the problem, like, you know, the call has been good enough to work, good enough to stay for a very long time. But what that does is that it says that rights are essentially connected to one's labor, right? So if you're able to work, if you're, you know, quote unquote, able-bodied and like slave in this capitalist system, then you may have a right to stay, which does disenfranchise a lot of people. I mean, part of the reason people get deported. So we know, for example, in Alberta, where temporary workers are coming into work on the tar sands and are getting hurt and are being deported because they don't have the right of status. It's the same in Manitoba, where people do not get nominated for the provincial nominee program if it seems that they're not able to work. And I think that is the logic, right? The logic is that we want people's bodies. We want them for a very specific period of time, but we don't want their spirit. We don't want their relationships, their ideas, their beings, right? And people are essentially being commodified. And you're right. It's across the board, right? So what we're seeing is that refugee numbers have been cut, permanent residency numbers have been cut. The family reunification program, just in the last 2 years, has seen 60% cutbacks in its funding. The IRB doesn't have, you know, enough hires in it. And essentially, what it is that we're moving towards a quote-unquote guest worker program, except guests are never treated like this, right? And it's part of an international switch. So the International Organization of Migration and the Global Forum for Migration and Development just have started meeting in the last 2 years, and they're designing the new way that they say people should move. And what it is that certain rich industrialized countries can mediate and control their populations by ensuring that there's a pool of people, labor they call it, that can come in and ensure that prices stay low for producers. And then whenever necessary, these people can be deported. And this system is being entrenched, and we see it, you know, across Europe. We see it in the United States, and we see it in Canada. Canada is actually the global front runner for these programs. These are the models everybody else wants to follow. And I think part of the reason is because it is so vicious. It is so vitriolic. It can so easily, you know, just like brush people away. And I think the logic is the logic that people are scared about, that there is, you know, a large amount of xenophobia that's been created around migrants, which has already been happening. But then all of this talk about climate change plays into it, right? It's this idea that everybody's coming to these quote-unquote safe havens that are responsible for destroying the world, and now these places are closing their borders. And I think it's really important for us to be able to fight back.
Hassan, this is part of a trend under Jason Kenney, although it's part of a consistent trend by all immigration ministers, whether liberal or conservative. Mm-hmm. Recently, here in Montreal, we tried to confront Jason Kenney. We presented him with a specific case of a Mexican woman named Grisa who was murdered in Mexico after twice trying to claim refugee status. And I'm wondering at this stage, and what we did was very symbolic and was, you know, it was very least that we could do, but it's obviously not changing policy. You have a lot of groups who are behind this coalition that's come together against these regulatory changes, but what do we need to be doing to actually get these policies back to where they have to be, which is towards status for all policies, towards policies that that provide people with basic dignity?
Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing, you know, a two-part fight. I mean, we've been put on the back foot where we're being pushed back and seeing, having to fight for, you know, rights we had and or we thought we were moving towards, right? So the refugee system is being dismantled. You know, further backtracking is happening in terms of the family reunification programs and the temporary work programs. So we see ourselves sort of on the back foot, and too often the instant urges is to just push back and try and reestablish what we believe already existed at the quote-unquote federal level. And I think that's really important, but what we also need to be doing is to, I guess, surge forward, right, and be very, very clear on what sort of communities we need to build. And I think particularly what that means is when necessary to take to the streets, when necessary creating spaces that are free of immigration enforcement, but largely to talk about what is it that we can do collectively. So here in Toronto, what we've done is we've gone after schools, for starters, and that schools must be accessible to non-status children. And today, Toronto is the only city in the country where non-status children are able to access schools. We then went after and alongside anti-VAW spaces, and today almost all of them are accessible to non-status people. We're doing the same work with health. We're doing the same work in food banks. And what we're trying to build is that no matter what the federal laws are, no matter what the federal policies are, we will make sure that their implementation, which is done by people, will be done differently. That we will create spaces that are safe, that are just, and that ensure dignity for all people. And so that is part of essentially creating a new language, a new way where our energies are not just focused on trying to change federal systems, because I'm not sure we can get a lot from these people, right? I think, but what we can do is to make it impossible for them to enforce their, you know, horrible laws. What we can do is we can change their, you know, we can change the way we think about these things. So I think it's particularly the work of cultural producers, people who are artists, who are writers, who are comic makers, who are illustrators, who are musicians, who are journalists, right? People, you know, with large friendship circles, people who throw parties, DJs, to try and include this talk, because there is so much rhetoric that has to be countered, and we have to create a counter mythology. We have this myth of the illegal worker. We have this myth of the terrorist. We have this myth of, you know, the welfare recipient. And all of these myths need to be shattered. And we need to create another story, a story that includes us. And that story must be taken up by all of us and said really loudly and articulated really well, but put out, you know, in a very conscious effort. I think people can come together and write books, create music. And those are really, and that is the work that supports, you know, the sort of organizing that it takes to, you know, find Jason Kenney on a street corner or to do a street takeover. And I think we're entering a very dramatic year. Like, you know, 2010 is going to see the GAG 20 meetings. It's going to see a federal election in Canada. Here in Toronto, we'll have mayoral elections. Unite Here is doing a walkout in the city. QP is doing province-wide strikes. There's the Winter Olympics. I mean, people are going to be energized in its time. And we're, you know, we're in the midst of a recession. And we have to take people's anger, take people's fears, and take people's hopes and bring them together. And, you know, move forward.
Hassan, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on No One's Legal Radio.
Okay, thank you so much.
Migo mi dizonal gitchi anamik ni nega kanamik ni derigak gitchi anamik adien in daman no gum ni dachi piji jigo ani de ne wat ni dachi giash kwe dachi miki da man ni zegi ziwina na nish koyaki ni pimo zepi ni chi gitchi ni boan
les premières nations je me souviens. Les premières nations, je me souviens. Les premières nations, je me souviens. Les premières nations, sérieux, c'est pas de leur faute. On est québécois, mais ils étaient là, ben avant nous autres. Les premières nations, ils ont toujours été là, real, recognize, real, t'as oublié ou quoi. Les premières nations, sérieux, c'est pas de leur faute. On est québécois, mais ils étaient là, ben avant nous autres. Les premières nations. Ils ont toujours été là, real, recognized, real, t'as oublié ou quoi? Sans révolter, comment ça se fait? Toi, qu'est-ce que tu ferais si je volais tout ce qui t'appartenait? Qu'on se le dise, puis qu'on arrête de faire les hypocrites. For real, la belle province, mais qui profite? C'est la même chose qui se passe en Afrique. Ceux qui ramassent les diamants sont pas riches, sont plutôt pauvres. Ici, ces réserves indiennes, ils ont juste leur smoke. Les armes, les jeunes fument plus de split, c'est juste la coke. Quand je vois ça, ça me jette par terre. Sérieux, regarde-moi pas comme si j'exagère. La dépression, c'est Katana Margi. La corruption dans les rues de Kanasataki. L'asphalte dans mon district, tu crèves dans l'aile. Le business, on roule d'ici jusqu'aux réserves indiennes. Y'en a un crise du buzz, les tripes d'alcool. Plus qu'une drogue, plus qu'un jeune qui sniffe la colle. Ça va mal, car y'a rien dans crise d'école. La violence conjugale, les victimes de viol. Jeune avec trop de vécu, à 15 ans, c'est un alcoolique. Une situation sans issue, pour vrai, nous c'est pas correct. C'est dread live, là c'est à côté. C'est dans le coin, t'as juste à prendre ton char. Puis monter, là c'est pas loin, son en ruine, bon. C'est au Canada, puis là-bas c'est quasiment le tiers-monde. Mère nature s'énerve, puis la terre gronde. La crise d'Oka, les Mohawks, les soldats, ils ont perdu leur terre, leur culture, c'est même pas drôle. Je sais quoi, puis sérieux c'est pas de leur faute. On est québécois, mais ils étaient là, ben avant nous autres. Christophe Colomb est arrivé, c'était pas la grosse amitié. C'était plein de richesses, master, sa boîte l'eau contaminée. T'as juste à vérifier, astique ça fait pitié. La vérité, c'est pas juste ici que c'est arrivé, aucune réaction. Critique la situation. Je me souviens des premières nations.
Anishinaabe, Atikamek, Inu, Mi'kmaq, Abenaki, Mohawk, Likri, Nescapi, Huron-Wendat, Malisit, jusqu'aux Inuits et Mi'kmaq.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. We were just listening to Samian with Sans Pression, a new track called Première Nation. To end our show, we'll hear about the recent disruption of the Olympic torch relay in Victoria this past October 30th.
Yeah, the torch relay is basically being protected. protected like a visiting dignitary or president. There's literally hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by all kinds of agencies. It's a huge security operation. I feel like I've said this before, but it's the largest security operation in Canadian history. And yet, activists out in Coast Salish territories where the torch relay was starting, specifically in the capital of BC, Victoria, were able to successfully disrupt it. They did so on the basis of the slogan no Olympics on stolen native land, and it was really inspiring that they were able to successfully disrupt this torch relay and draw some attention to some real issues besides the Olympic spectacle.
It's true. Kind of by disrupting it, they're actually able to get some press talking about the real issues that are at stake when you talk about the Olympics happening on stolen native land, such as the displacement of the people who, like, there's never been a treaty signed on this land, so the displacement of the people who justifiably should be living there, as well as just gentrification and, like, moving out homeless people in Vancouver, period. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's an issue we've explored on this show in the past, and probably again, because the Olympics themselves will be taking place in February. The torch relay is actually coming through Montreal on December 10th. I know the date. Doesn't mean I'm going to disrupt it myself, but December 10th, the torch relay is coming through. So to get a firsthand account of the disruption of the torch relay, I was able to speak with Tamara Herman. Tamara actually has been a contributor to CKUT in the past, but she now lives in Victoria. Victoria's gain is our loss. She's a member of No 2010 Victoria. There's a second interview that I did with another member of No 2010 Victoria, Zoe Blunt, but due to time constraints, I won't be able to play her interview on the live show, but that's something that I will be playing on the upload. No One's Legal always uploads our shows, and so we'll be hearing from two members of No 2010 Victoria. But for now, we'll get a first-hand account of what went down in Victoria on October 30th with the disruption of the torch relay. We'll go to that interview right now. I'm on the line with Tamara Herman from Victoria, British Columbia. Tamara is a member of No 2010 Victoria. Tamara, welcome to No One's Legal Radio.
Thanks, Jackie.
Tamara, the torch relay, the Olympic torch relay, started in your town, Victoria, and you and many, many other people were able to not just show your opposition to it, but actually disrupt this torch relay, despite all the hype about security, despite all the hype about preventing people from getting near the torch, despite all the surveillance and police interventions, you were able to successfully do so. So could you describe for our listeners how you were able to do so? What happened on October 30th as that Bombardier-May torch made its way through the streets of Victoria?
Well, we really had no idea what to expect from the outset. The torch, we knew at the end of the day, was going to go to the legislature building, and there were police barricades all along the building as well as along the torch relay route. So as we were going into our demonstration on the 30th, we really had no idea what to expect when we got to the torch. And because of timing, we kind of had a long and winding stake march through Victoria. And we stopped for a little while at one of the busiest intersections of the city where a big Royal Bank branch is located. And RBC, of course, is one of the Olympics' key sponsors as well as one of the major investors in the tar sands. So we occupied the intersection for about half an hour, which basically paralyzed the city. And then after, we went up to blockade the torch. And interestingly, there were a lot of people kind of lining the roads waiting for the torch to come, but there just wasn't very much security. So we were able to walk down the route. And according to the information we had, the organizers ended up putting the torch out, sticking it in a van, and driving it to another area, and then taking a back route to the legislature. So we were able to disrupt the torch relay.
The irony of that measure was that's exactly what happened in places like San Francisco and Paris 2 years ago when the torch relay was being disrupted by Free Tibet protesters, and now it's happening here in Canada. Talk more about the issues that are motivating you and others to disrupt this relay and to use this opportunity and all the international attention focused on this torch to raise other issues.
Well, most of us organizing here on the West Coast, on Coast Salish territories, are organizing under the banner No Olympics on Stolen Native Land, and that's because most of the land in British Columbia still has not been through any kind of treaty process. It's still unceded territories. And so Of course, a lot of us are working with different First Nations groups on land restitution and decolonization issues, and that has been a major focus of our campaign. But of course, on the other side, we have Phil Fontaine working for RBC and four host nations up in Whistler signing contracts with the Olympics to host the Games in February. So there's definitely a lot of complexities, but that's still one of the key messages that we're organizing around. Other than that, I think one of the reasons we were able to mobilize as many as we did in Victoria is because there's so much outrage over government expenditures. Both Victoria and Vancouver have a very disproportionate level of local poverty. Here in Victoria, we have upwards of 1,500 homeless people, and this is a town with a population of 70,000, and we only have 400 shelter beds. So there's definitely a crisis on the streets in Victoria right now. We haven't had a fixed site needle exchange since it was closed down 16 months ago. The BC government has made all sorts of cutbacks in areas like support to victims of domestic violence, the arts, and even amateur sports, of all things. So there's definitely a lot of anti-Olympic sentiment coming from the fact that the Games are costing us $6 billion, most of which is publicly funded. And in Victoria, we've had a year where there's been lots of organizing around local poverty issues. So we were able to just kind of work with that energy, and really it came together on its own just because there's so much outrage.
This marks a culmination of sorts, because the torch was going to be focused on, and it started in your town, but it's also the beginning of continuing to raise these issues. So can you speak more about that ongoing campaign locally, but also more generally under the theme of no Olympics on stolen land?
Well, the torch is going on a 45,000 kilometer journey that's costing upwards of $50 million. And we know, we've heard that there's going to be different events, anti-torch relay events organized across the country. And I think that's because the same issues that resonate in Vancouver, that resonate in Victoria, around the appropriation of First Nations land and around the flawed treaty process and around kind of ongoing systemic poverty in First Nations communities, spreads across the country. It's not just limited to British Columbia. So I know that the security officials have stated that they're worried about certain communities, you know, such as Six Nations in Ontario, and I think that there's definitely going to be a lot of noise as the torch moves across the country. One thing about organizing the Olympics is that the issues that we're talking about are issues that began before the Olympics. You know, obviously, poverty, homelessness, access to health services for drug users, and, you know, land restitution and colonization. Obviously, these issues predate the Olympics here in BC and as well as across Canada, and they're going to continue afterwards as well. So I think that it's kind of an interesting window for us to organize and for us to really raise some of the important issues that we're all working together with. But it's ongoing work, and it's not going to end after the Games in February.
Tamara Herman, member of No Olympics 2010 in Victoria, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on No One's Legal Radio.
Thank you.
That just about wraps up the November edition of No One's Legal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of CKUT's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal. www.ckut.ca on the web. We're on the first Thursday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. Our next show will be December 3rd. Also, don't forget to check out our website for regular updates and uploaded audio, including the interview with Zoe Blunt with No 2010 Victoria that we weren't able to run on the show. Our website is www.noonisillegal.org. This month's show is produced by members of No One Is Illegal Network in Montreal in conjunction with the CKUT Community News Collective. No One Is Illegal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance, fighting for justice and dignity and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. Our campaign is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, denouncing and taking action to combat racial profiling, police brutality, detentions, and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island.